Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on chumbacasino.com. I looked over at the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Coincidence? I think not. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere, even at 30,000 feet. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's chumbacasino.com and live the Chumba life. No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where
prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus. Judy was boring.
Hello.
Then Judy discovered chumbacasino.com.
It's my little escape.
Now Judy's the life of the party.
Oh, baby. Mama's bringing home the bacon.
Whoa. Take it easy, Judy. The Chumba life is for everybody. So go to ChumbaCasino.com and play over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Ch-ch-chumba. ChumbaCasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Entire globe involving hundreds of different cultures explaining the same phenomenon by different names.
The nature of the footprints, namely their remarkable consistency, their biomechanical appropriateness, those aspects that are extremely compelling.
Hey everyone, welcome to the Bigfoot Influencers Podcast. I'm Dana.
And I'm Tim. How are you guys doing?
We're so excited to have you here.
Oh, we're thrilled. Yeah.
I know.
Yeah.
We have a very special guest tonight. But first, we wanted to talk about something super exciting. So Doug Hychek is working on making a new Sasquatch Legend Meets Science. So it's going to be part two. So Tim, why don't you tell everybody about that?
Yeah. So right now, it's super exciting. I mean, if we all can agree that it's probably one of the best documentaries on the subject.
By far.
And at least, you know, our opinion at least. But,
right.
and it's 20 years later and he's working on part two.
Yeah.
So he's right now, they're doing a Kickstarter campaign. So make sure you go to the Untold Radio, AM.com. You can find, go to any of the social medias and you can find the Kickstarter campaign. They're going to let us be part of that. So you put a little bit into it and you get to be part of the documentary. It's super exciting. They're going to be, I won't do it any justice by explaining what it's about, but obviously we know what it's about because it's part two of the first one. So,
right. And there's that really awesome trailer too.
Yes.
Yeah. You guys can check out as well.
And we'll have that on the next podcast. I just didn't have the trailer up ready for you guys now. And the interest of time.
Hey, guess what? We are super excited to have the legendary Henry Franzoni on tonight. So Tim, why don't you tell everybody about Henry?
Here's the thing. I'm just setting you guys up. You're going to get that, you know, we could talk to Henry for hours and hours and hours. There's so much to Henry and he's got so much history in the subject. I mean, it's just amazing. It's an honor to have him here.
It definitely is.
I mean, he was involved with the early researchers. He's been on TV shows. He's helped with books. He's authored his own books. He's been in documentaries. It just goes on and on.
And he's also a musician as well. Oh,
yeah.
Yeah, let's not forget about that.
And we're going to get into that with one of the early documentaries he was in. So we'll get into that with Henry, though. So
absolutely.
We're really excited. So let's bring him in.
Yeah. Hey, Henry. Welcome to the show.
Greetings. Hey, greetings. Greetings and salutations.
Yes, salutations.
Yes.
As they say in lots of countries, they say salute or salute. Yep. Salutations means good health.
Yes.
Yep.
Oh.
And hello.
Hey, hi. Yeah, what a quite an intro there. I don't know what to say, but I've been at this a long time. Yeah.
30 years. Can see the drums in the background, Henry. Are you going to play for us?
No, wasn't planning to at the moment.
I'm joking.
That's another episode.
My office, and yes, I have my drums.
Good for you. It's a very cool background.
It is going on.
Yeah, my office. It's my office background. Yes, the retired office, because this is my retirement office at home.
Good for it's you. Amazing, yes. Yeah, we were just talking before the show how Henry's originally from New Jersey. Now he lives in Oregon, and he's been living there for, did you say 27 years?
40.
Oh, 47 years.
Well, I moved here. I moved here in 1974. Oh. So actually, I've lived here 49 years now. Yeah, wow. 49, almost 50 years.
1974 was 49 years ago.
Yeah. Don't get me started with the math.
Yeah, took me a while there myself. Isn't that scary? I could not do that very quickly, you know.
Tim's in good my at mind. That. Don't worry.
Yeah. Yeah. So yeah, no, I've lived here almost 50 years. I fell in love with the Northwest when I came here when I was 17, and I moved here. I moved here right after high school. So I graduated high school, and I was an interloper that came here interfering with everything. But over the years, I've become, well, it's strange because I'm friends with a lot of people that were born here and natives from here. I met them all right after they graduated high school. So it's like I kind of grew up with them. I grew up with them for part of their childhood. I feel very at home in the Northwest for sure.
So what can you just like a real quick question, because we were talking so much about New Jersey and all the places that you lived. So what can you, because we're East Coasters, obviously, and yes, we've traveled to the West. What's something that you could tell somebody who lives on the East Coast? What some things that make the West Coast so awesome?
The biggest difference is here you really have to respect the mountains. Out on the East Coast, mountains are dinky little things. There's not really much to them compared to the West Coast. And the Cascades and the Rockies and the Wallowas and the Seven Devils Mountains and the Blue Mountains, all these mountain ranges around here, you know, typically mountains in those ranges are 8,000 to 9,000 feet. So there's nothing like that on the East Coast. And the amount of wilderness is really, you know, Oregon's 96,000 square miles. A tiny Indian reservation such as the Yakima Nation is the size of Delaware. To give you a
comparison.
That's
where we're from, guys.
right. That it's a really good match too. You have like the same within a couple of square miles of each other in surface area. But the difference about the Yakima Res is that it's full of 8,000 foot mountains. So it's much bigger than Delaware if you flatten it all out, you know, because it's just up and down, it's really severe terrain. So that kind of size is what's really different. You know, here in the West, we measure distance in terms of how many hours it takes to get there. It's just a 6-hour trip or a 3-hour. We don't really think in terms of actual miles because it's too big a number. So I was surprised that you could get here in the West, you could really get out there in the bush and you would be far from anything. And you can get to a place where maybe a couple of people have traveled in the last 100 years, just like 50, 60 miles outside of town. That's not like the East Coast. You know, the East Coast is way denser and there's nothing like that. But here, you can basically go to almost unexplored territory, you know, 100 miles from Portland. Wow. So,
yeah, that's definitely a super cool feature about living on the West Coast. But so were most of the Bigfoot researchers that you collaborated with there on the West Coast?
My collaboration period ended in the year 2000, but up till 2000, it was I at first was, the first things I did was I helped with the Peter Byrne and the Bigfoot Research Project, and I was on his board of advisors in 1993 to 1998. So those 5 years. And Peter Byrne's board of advisors had myself, Robert Michael Pyle, John Cordell, trying to think who else was on there. Bobby Short, possibly. William Sachs Weir, an Indian mythology expert. And anyhow, it was an interesting group. And then I met and helped Ray Crow create the track record for his Western Bigfoot Society. And I got him a computer so that he could put out a newsletter with an IBM PC clone. And I actually got Peter Byrne to pay for Ray Crow's computer. So I was negotiating deals between them at that time. And, you know, so I was like an instigator. I've always been an instigator. And so I helped Ray Crow put out the track record for the Western Bigfoot Society. And I helped Peter Byrne with the Bigfoot Research Project until that all fell apart in 1998. And then by the year 2000, I gave up public Bigfoot stuff and I actually became a fisheries scientist and I went to work for the tribes and actually just did biology for 20 years. So,
yeah, so we're going to get into that. That's part, that's part 1.5 of this interview.
And
I got a bunch of interesting questions about the what he did with the tribes. So go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, I was kind of curious, and maybe as well as some of the viewers are curious about what got Henry interested in the subject in the first place. But did you want to save that for last too?
I see that look I'm getting, Henry.
No, because he mentioned it to me.
Yeah,
but people
let's do
might
it.
Be,
okay,
let's
yeah.
hear it. Henry, we want to know, like, what got you so interested in the subject of Bigfoot?
So, 1993, I'm part Indian. I'm white as white can be, but I have a tiny bit of Indian in me. And I'm fascinated.
I think I see that, Henry.
I think I see it
in your bone structure and your hair. Like you have
At age 66, to actually have hair and not a receding hairline.
You got some good
seems
hair.
To be a Native American trait, I have to say. Yep. You know, like I'm like, you know, I think I got Indian hair. I don't have a receding hairline and I'm 66. So yeah, it's nice to have hair at 66. Kind of a shock, you know. But yeah, so I was always interested in that. And I started, my first thing was I went to a place camping with my wife where the evil god of the woods was supposed to live, according to an old Indian legend I saw written down. And I said, wow, you know, and it was named Skookum Lake in Clackamas County, Oregon. And I said, man, you know, let's go see if the evil god of the woods still lives there. Ha, 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 ha. That was the big joke. And so I dragged my wife up there on a Friday night, and we ran into something really weird. You know, like we didn't see anything, but, you know, we had all kinds of, I hate to say it, woo-woo experiences. Yes.
So can you give us an example?
Our starter motor got blown out by a force field and we were marooned and had to hike out. And I had to come back with a friend and replace the starter motor in order to drive the van we were driving out again. So that was a concrete thing.
It was a force field that?
Yeah. Yeah. Force field.
A force
projected,
field like
projected from what you would term a Bigfoot, an invisible Bigfoot, even weirder, standing in front of the van that I couldn't see, but I could smell it. And this energy field came washing over the van and blew out the starter motor and shut the van off, and I couldn't turn it back on again.
So you could actually feel something.
Yeah. In all the hair, this long hair we were talking about just recently, was, I didn't have it in a ponytail. It stood out 1 foot in all directions, like I had rubbed balloons and held them over my head. I mean, static electricity made my hair go out like this. It looked really funny, you know, like a giant, you know, sun of static foot-long hair pointing out. So, yeah, I knew it was static electricity, you know, like I could, and all the hair in my arms and everything, and it washed over the van, and we were marooned, you know. And then the smell went away, right? So the stinky smell that smelled just like a wet dog, really smelly wet dog, was on the wind, and then it was gone after we got zapped, completely zapped. So that being the very first 5 minutes I looked for Bigfoot, that affected my entire Bigfoot career, okay?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because so you said there was an invisible Bigfoot.
Yes.
Well, he meant the fourth,
yes,
right?
I feel that my headlights, I feel, I don't know where the Bigfoot was, but I couldn't see it. And the headlights were just going straight ahead into the inky black. It was about midnight on August 1st, 1993. And we were at about 5,000 feet, right about Skookum Lake, just short of it. And the details are, I missed the turn to Skookum Lake. And when I turned around and came back, like a quarter mile, I had gone out of my way. The smell was there on my way back, but it wasn't there when I went up the road, only when I came back down. And so then I stopped because the smell came, and then boom, I got zapped, and the static electricity took out my starter motor. And yeah. Oh, and then furthermore, I leave out these details. I shouldn't. My wife looked at me and said, I'm going to take a nap. And she just passed right out.
Whoa.
And it was totally weird, you know, like not like her behavior at all. It happened right as the giant spark, my hair was standing out. And so I took a like selective, it seemed to have a selective ability to put my wife to sleep and make my hair stand up on end and blow the starter motor. So, and I didn't see it, right? I call it invisible because I didn't see it, but freaked me out. And
yeah,
I said to myself, wow, you know, because of the smell, because the smell was so much like a wet dog that your mind could picture a hairy giant, you know, because that's what the smell was. You were like, oh man, that's like a hairy giant smell if I ever smelled one, but didn't see anything. But knew something was there, but I said immediately, I said, this is not an ape.
So your wife, so she went to sleep.
Yeah. She woke up about 5 minutes later. About 5 minutes later, she woke back up.
And did she say anything? Or
no, like, no, she just said, what happened? And I told her what happened. I said, well, actually, this spark came. You went, passed out. Yeah, I did. I got really tired. And then, you know, the smell went away. And she smelled the smell. That happened. She knew that. So she was there for the first part of it.
Right.
Yeah, that's just crazy.
Oh, and all the crickets stopped too. That was the other thing.
We've
the crickets
heard that.
Just went dead silent. So while the smell was there, and as soon as the smell left, the crickets came back. So it was my first Bigfoot experience in 1993. And I realized immediately that we weren't dealing with an ape or animal, a simple animal. This, no way was this a simple animal. And that made me an outcast from the Bigfoot Research Project, from the Western Bigfoot Society, from all those early groups, because I said, no, you guys, this has happened to me. I've had this experience. I know you're not dealing with a simple gorilla.
Because you had started with the groups before or after that experience. It was after that experience, right?
Right after. Like the next day I met Peter Byrne, and 2 days later I met Ray Crow. So August 2nd, August 3rd is when I met Ray Crow and Peter Byrne.
And I know you said you felt like an outcast, and you and I have chatted briefly about this before, but they still let you hang around. So even though you think you're an outcast, you were still in the group.
Yeah, I'm really useful. You know, I'm like a handy person to have around. I have a sort of natural ability with some of these things. So I came up, I guess my utility was, pardon me, I came up with a lot of original ideas for how to approach the problem, and they really liked that. You know, I'm imaginative. I have a strong imagination. So they said, oh, that's handy. And back then too, I'm a real early computer guy. So I had all these computer skills that I could apply that later all of you in the world apply all the time. So I was like really early into GIS. In 1993, I knew how to map data with GIS. And in 1993, nobody really knew how to do that, you know, but I did. And I knew all about databases and how to construct Boolean logic queries and things. And I was really handy with computers. I'm really handy with computers. So I helped the project out a lot with all of its data processing stuff in the beginning because I have a bunch of weird skill sets. But it turned out that I was really good at that. And I applied computers to biology as a career. So, you know, then I had a 25-year career as a computer fisheries biologist sort of thing.
But you also created websites for a bunch of
researchers. Well, yeah, because I was like the only guy that was really hip to computers back then. the children hadn't grown up yet.
Right.
So I made websites for Rene DeHinde and Peter Byrne. I made one for Patty Patterson, Roger's wife, but we never put it online. We killed it because she got paranoid about people stealing. I made one for Ron Moorhead and Sierra Sounds. I was actually the first. No, I was the second. I was the second web designer Ron ever had. I was number two, not number one. I made one for, John Green and Grover Krantz and I ended up collaborating on websites in a way, but Grover Krantz had he had one of the very, very first websites. The only person that tied me, two of the first 500 websites ever were Bigfoot related, the Western Bigfoot Society and the Bigfoot Research Project. So Bigfoot had two websites out of the first 500 websites, period, that ever were. That's how early Bigfoot was on the internet. And wow. Grover Krantz was there too. Isn't that nuts? Grover Krantz was there too because he had students at Walla Walla College that would sell his Gigantopithecus replicas on the web as soon as the web was invented. And they would sell track casts. And so Grover had this really primitive website, but sure enough, it was like he could sell track casts and that dang Gigantopithecus skull that he had in every interview he ever did. You know, I mean, he was the other, because he had all these students who were like, hey, man, you know, you got to sell your thing on the web, man. So the students hooked him up right away. It's like, I'm talking 1993, like October, the web being actually invented about June of 93. So, you know, 6 months later, Grover was selling, is all I can say. You know?
That's crazy.
And I was pitching the Bigfoot search for both the Western Big. I had newsletters online, and I was trying to get, you know, people into the search for Bigfoot. I was promoting Bigfoot at that time. Yes.
So you did you also help Matt Moneymaker when he?
Oh yeah, Moneymaker. Well, yeah, he started as a subdirectory on my site.
Which was what? Tell the audience what that was. Yeah.
I gave him a subdirectory on the Western Bigfoot Society site. And I taught him all about the web. You see what can happen when you misuse these benefits for weapons of destruction. Yes. I've always felt, you know, Mick, I showed Matt how it worked, and Matt just took off. Like, you know, he wanted to run his own show, and he had his own dream. And he and I did not share the same dream, and he wanted to do his thing. I'm kind of proud of him because he succeeded, you know, in like making his dream come true. And he kind of stated what he has done. He told me in dream form before he did it. So, you know, I'm like, yeah, you know, he wanted to do that, and I did not, but he did. So yay Matt. But yeah, I just thought it was not the direction I was going. I wanted to understand the problem and solve the problem. That's my, I was like more sciencey than business minded, you know. Like I, at that time, Matt and my big difference was I felt if you made any money, you were corrupting your posture, and you could be criticized for being in it just for the money. So in order to be pure and only be in it for the love of Bigfoot, you know, you can't make any money. So I was really like an idealistic asshole that was like, hey, you can't make any money with Bigfoot. That's gonna corrupt your authoritative position and your dignity. Oh my god. So you know, Matt thought I was probably insane, and you know, what can I say? I'm totally insane. So, you know,
yeah. And my impression that I get from a lot of our, you know, big, you know, people in the Bigfoot world is I don't really think there's that much money to be made in the world of Bigfoot to begin with.
Oh my God. Well, that's my life. I mean, I had a dream once. I wrote a book, and I told myself I'd never read a Bigfoot book. I said, no, I'll never do this. Well, fuck that. And then in 2008, I was unemployed. And sure enough, I was like, well, I'm going to write a bestseller. And I'm going to make money writing a Bigfoot book. That was, you know, that was the idea. But what I realized is that, no, that's not a big market. Really, the demographic is not large. And I did make about $10,000. That I have to say, I wrote that book, and I did it punk style, where I did it all myself, and I got my own, I cleared all the copyrights and got an ISBN number and did the whole thing, published it myself, and therefore collected all profits. And by doing that, I did make 10,000 bucks, but I learned a lot, you know, like don't make a book with 60 color pages because it's really expensive mm-hmm. to print. That, you know, that's really, really expensive. So, yeah, I got stuck with I'm not a businessman, you know.
But so for the audience, and the name of the book was In the Spirit of Sitko.
Siatko. Yeah, Siatko. Yeah, I mean, it's, I don't know exactly how to pronounce it, but because all the tribes in the Northwest have like a slightly different dialectical pronunciation or a different word, but Siatko is what I've always gone with, you know. So, yeah.
So, hey, Henry, how did you get involved with working with the Native American tribes?
The whole thing's related because I started spending a lot of time in the woods starting in 93 looking for Bigfoot. And I was going out extensively in the woods. And I came to early, I decided that Bigfoot was a true conservationist and was actually, I was trying to get a bead on what their function was in nature. And I began to think that what their function was that
Judy was boring.
Hello.
Then Judy discovered Chumbacasino.com.
It's my little escape.
Now Judy's the life of the party.
Oh, baby, mama's bringing home the bacon.
Whoa, take it easy, Judy. The Chumba life is for everybody. So go to Chumbacasino.com and play over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on ChumbaCasino.com. I looked over at the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Coincidence? I think not. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere, even at 30,000 feet. So sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's ChumbaCasino.com and live the Chumba life.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
They were taking care of all the different species in nature. And I started to see that Indian tribes, as I studied the lore and studied all the oral histories I could find, basically said the same thing. And I said, wow, you know, maybe I'm onto something. Maybe Bigfoot is a conservationist. Maybe being a conservationist is really like a good thing to do with yourself in this life, taking care of the other species. And I sort of got the hint because I thought that's what Bigfoot was up to. And it took me to, you know, it's kind of strange. I mean, how it all happened, it's almost predestined. But yeah, I applied for a job out of the newspaper one day, and it just so happened that the collection of tribes on the Columbia River, the 16 tribes on the Columbia River, needed a person with my strange collection of skill sets. And I was a perfect fit and was the highest rated applicant out of 75 applicants. And so I wound up working for the tribes.
What were some of your skill sets, Henry, that were so important for them?
The tribes all saw my Bigfoot movie that I made in 1996, which has a lot of tribal stuff in it. And I turned out over time that basically every Indian I met had seen that movie. And what they drew from that movie, which the Western audience does not draw from that movie, is that I would never hurt another animal. And many Indians would ask me when they recognized that I was the guy that played drums in that Bigfoot movie, they go, instead of like white people, which would all go, oh, wow, you played drums in the Bigfoot movie. All the Indians would say, wow, you would never hurt another animal, would you? So completely different culture, completely different audience reaction, completely different. And I still don't understand how they see that in me, but they all saw that in me. And so that was one key attribute, And then I'm like really, I'm gifted at building computer models of for survival. So I like published a lot of science where I model the survival through all the dams on the Columbia River and how salmon survive each reach of the river and each route of passage through the dams, the 128 different routes of passage through the 8 dams on the main stem of the Columbia River, and just a super intricate computer model of encompassing all kinds of environmental conditions and things. And I just happened to have a knack, because I grew up with computers like the kids of today do, that I can just make these models of the biological world that scientists explain to me what they want the model to do, and then I can make the model. So I can like make it all happen in silicon. That's my one of my greatest gifts. Then I'm just like a natural born bullshit artist, and I can do the politics necessary to actually navigate the complex political situation involving the salmon, let us put it at that, yes, on a daily basis. And there's a lot of people skills involved. It's like programming under combat conditions, because you're battling NOAA and you're battling the Corps of Engineers every day in an endless math battle where you're trying to do better science and better math than they are, faster than them. So it's very I happen to be well suited for that emotionally. Like, you can put me in a foxhole and I'll jam the code out and do the math while the shells are flying. While the shells fly by, I can still just get my math done. So I mean, it's a bunch of stuff, but also I have a really good understanding of salmon biology, and I've learned in 25 years how an awful lot of just biology and science, because I've been out there measuring the environment and building quantitative models of the environment and all the populations of creatures in it. And that's what I did for the tribes. Is it spread to other things. I would do sturgeon and lamprey and salmon and steelhead, and then moved into a little bit of deer and elk and huckleberries, and the list goes on. But
so through that, Henry, that's what you were able to, how'd you start, you know, getting them to discuss their beliefs and, you know, on the subject of Bigfoot, and what'd you learn from that?
Well, I don't know how I don't really ever even get them to start. Like, everybody knows that I'm the crazy white guy that's mm-hmm. really into Bigfoot and is like a weird salmon scientist that works for their salmon think tank, because I work for the Columbia River Intertribal Fish Commission, which is a tribal think tank of scientists and lawyers and weird people like me, right? So, they would bring it up. What I'm saying is and things would happen. I had a project that I created, that I ran, and I had a meeting in Hood River, Oregon, because it was central to the four tribes I was working for. I was working for the Nez Perce, Warm Springs, Umatilla, and Yakima. And all four tribes could get to Hood River. It's like a equidistant spot for them. So we're at this meeting, and the meeting room I borrowed from the police, because there was an intertribal police force that I worked alongside. I was on the scientist side and police were on the law enforcement side. So I borrowed their meeting room. And while I was holding my meeting, an officer came in And he said, I have a cell phone of him. And he passed around the cell phone video that he had just taken of what you would say is a Bigfoot swimming across the Columbia River. And all of us in the room, there are about 10, 15 of us, we all looked at the cell phone. We all were like, wow, look at that. And we all watched it two or three times. It was about 2 minutes long. And when we got to the end, everyone in the room, by the way, only referred to that as him. Hmm. Not Bigfoot, him. And at the end, the officer deleted it, and that was that. And see, that wouldn't happen in white culture, but that's how it goes down in every day in Indian country. So, you know, I know that's hard to understand, but it's really a different culture.
And yeah, I can imagine. Yeah. You know, I mean, it's older. Yeah. It's an older culture.
It's different priorities, and they don't consider Bigfoot. They could, you know, they know they, as a culture, they know more about Bigfoot, and they know a lot more about what Bigfoot is, who Bigfoot is, and what's going on.
So, in my opinion, do these Native tribes that you've worked with, do they agree with you in your theory of Bigfoot not being an ape, that there's more to it? Do they agree?
Oh, I'd say without, you know, I can't speak for them. I always say this, it's true. But let me just say this one introductory thing. I can't speak for the tribes, but I can allow them to be heard. And I always try to walk that line because it's hard. But yeah, I would say every tribe has a continuum of knowledge about Bigfoot. Every individual tribe member may know a different amount or greater or lesser amount about Bigfoot. They know what we all mean by Bigfoot, but over there, they know their people, and they know their people, and almost all of them know their Indians, even a type, another tribe. I'd say in general, all tribes know that Bigfoot's another tribe. Yeah, I'd say that. I'm not violating any confidence by saying in general, every tribe I've worked for, that somewhere, at least, you know, 30% of the tribal members think that Bigfoot's another tribe. But you'll find the same disagreements in the tribe that you find in white society. You know, you find a bunch of Indians that go, no, Bigfoot's not real, it's a hoax. And you find a bunch of Indians that go, no, no, it's my ancestor. And a bunch of them will say, no, it's our protector, it's our tribal protector. So you get a lot of different stories as you go around. And everything's balkanized inside tribes because longhouses, you see, stories about Bigfoot are proprietary and are owned by the longhouse. At least in the river longhouse culture, which I'm familiar with, because Pacific Northwest tribes, mostly salmon tribes, and these salmon tribes each have a longhouse, and all the longhouses on the river are in theory connected into being one big longhouse. However, Bigfoot stories get attached to a single longhouse. And so if you're a member of that longhouse, you're aware of a certain set of stories about Bigfoot. Another longhouse, different set of stories. Another long, different. And they're jealously guarded. Like, one of the ways I think I can explain why I seem to get so many stories is I'm not a threat because I'm an outsider. I'm a white guy. So I'm not a longhouse to longhouse competition. I don't have a dog in the fight. So a lot of people tell me things that they don't share with other Indians because they're competitors. And, you know, I'm well known. See, because I did work for the tribes trying to restore their salmon and mitigate everything and restore, and I went to court twice for them in the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals and won two cases. So I'm like a warrior for the tribes. You know, I've got like a reputation and contacts or friends. I have a lot of tribal friends, you know. So, you know, at this point, it's not like I get tribal people to talk about Bigfoot or anything. It's like, it's actually like this. I'll be out in the middle of a res, and it'll be a small group of people, and there'll be a bunch of biologists like me mixed with a bunch of tribal people. And we'll be doing some project like, you know, replanting on a stream bank or something, you know, some habitat restoration. And it'll get dark, and bit by bit, the white people will all leave, and it'll just be tribal people and me. And when it gets down to tribal people and me, we only talk about UFOs and Bigfoot, period.
So, it's like they know you're the safe. It's everyone's gone now. It's our time with Henry.
You can talk to Henry about UFOs and Bigfoot now. And so as soon as all the white people leave, it's just like 24/7 Bigfoot, UFOs, Bigfoot, UFOs. So, yeah, that's how it is for me. You know, it's like karma, cool, you know, yeah. It's like, I'm like, oh boy. Okay. Well, I earned it. And now I earned that karma.
Yeah. And you've been on multiple movies and documentaries, regarding the subject. We actually just saw one recently. Mm-hmm.
The Flash of Beauty, where Henry was talking about, you were talking about the longhouses in that documentary.
Yeah. I remember. Well, now that I've come back to the thing, you know, I sort of have a whole different perspective and a whole different story now that I've worked for the tribes for 25 years. You know, my views about Bigfoot have really changed a lot. But yeah, I swore off those in 2000, no more Bigfoot films. And then 2 years ago, I said, no, okay, I'm retiring. I'm going to open the door, and I'm going to start talking to Bigfoot people. I have been just talking to the tribes about Bigfoot for the last 25 years, just not talking to white people about it. So, right. You know, it's.
Yeah. Well, you were mentioning before too, that you feel like that you don't have a club that you fit into, you know, like there's all these Bigfoot groups and I mean, I'm sure there's enough people who have your, you know, your belief, your knowledge, whatever you want to call it, that Bigfoot is not an ape in the woods, that there's something more to it. So there's tons of people who share that. There's no club for that.
Well, no, I mean, it's, well, let's talk about your early guy, Peter Byrne.
Okay.
He believed they were people. His whole project was modeled on the idea that Jane Goodall had the right idea, and he was going to go and approach Bigfoot socially and try to communicate with them. That was the original goal of the Bigfoot Research Project, to Hinden, Krantz, John Green. Why, they just did nothing but rip him a new one for that whole idea. They said, oh my God, you know, we need a body. It's a dang creature. It's just like a dog or a bear. Go kill one. Come on. And Peter Byrne was a lot more enlightened and said, no, it's a person, and let's try to do what Jane Goodall did and communicate with them. So that was in 1993. That was ridiculed by pretty much every Bigfoot Maine person that you know. But, you know, in the end, I think he's correct. That was always correct. And yeah, it's not just that simple. It's more like spirit person. You know, it's not just person. It's, it gets far stranger than that. Believe me, what most Indian cultures think about Bigfoot is something completely surprising and not what you would suspect.
So, it's like, hey, a
cliffhanger,
Henry,
right there, man.
Why don't you tell us? Because you've had other encounters, obviously, besides.
Yeah, I've had a million of them.
So, like, why don't you share with us some of the most significant, or that you feel were the most significant for whatever reason?
Excluding his
sure, person. Sure. Excluding I'll tell you. Right, well, I'll tell you. I'll tell you a couple. The most significant one, as it turns out, and the seed that led to my new book, which is called Failing in a Cooler Way, How I Never Found Bigfoot, by the way.
That's a great title.
Cool, yeah.
So, the seed is this story. In 1994, a bunch of us from the Western Bigfoot Society got a report that two elk hunters had seen two big feet out by the intersection of Fall Creek and the Nehalem River, which is way up near the headwaters of the Nehalem River. Now, I was like big on Nehalem River Indian stories because I had found a whole set of Tillamook and Nehalem Indian stories about the wild woman that lived up the Nehalem River and the wild man that lived up the Nehalem River. And I had found a lot of references to it. So I was like, wow, you know, Bigfoot seen where the Indian stories said they were. And so five or six of us went out there, my wife, Ray Crow, a bunch of other guys. And one guy was like Mr. Hunter Yahoo. And he had a 45 and he strapped the 45 to his leg. And he was just ready for anything, man. He's ready for bear. So my wife was actually an Alaskan state trooper, ex-Alaskan state trooper. But she was like, in terms of, you know, if you rated somebody badass from 1 to 10, she was a 10. You know, like on Survivor, she would survive. She was just... And, you know, she had like hunted for food for most of her childhood, you know, so she knew how to stalk game for like 9-10 days. And she's really was a serious ass.
Yeah,
that's super cool.
And so she looked at me and we looked at this guy with this 45 on his leg and we were like, what an asshole. So we both said, we got to ditch these guys. So we took off. We basically looked at everybody and said, oh, I got a flat tire. I got to go back to the van and change my tire. So we'll see you later. So we went back to the van and we were like, God, man, you know, guy was, you know, bad vibe, you know, and a bush. We're on the bank of the river and there's a bush about 30 feet from us. And it's about 20 feet around and maybe 20 feet high. And I smoke a joint with my wife and I start talking about the Big Bang because, I mean, what do you do when you smoke a joint? It's like, yes. And then the birth of the universe. Yes. And we were big explosion. Yeah. So we, you know, we had this. So I'm telling this story about the Big Bang. And this huge laughter starts coming out of the bush that's 20 feet away from us, 30 feet away from us. And it sounds really deep, like a movie version of a gorilla laughing, you know, like a real deep resonant laughter, like, ha, 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 ha. You know, and I'm like going, whoa, that's really, you know, and I look at my wife and I go, is that Bigfoot laughing at my story?
See, I would be like, oh my God, baby, this is good stuff.
Well, we were both smoking it, right? It was like, we were both wondering. We were wondering if the weed was too good. You know, we were wondering. But both of us were like stunned by this. And I kept talking and I said, I think he's laughing at my story about the Big Bang. And as I said that, the laughter stopped on a dime. I mean, like in a millisecond, as soon as I began to make a sound, and then right at the very end of my phrase, the second I stopped speaking, the laughter started again. Being a drummer, as I am, this call and response, I'm very sensitive to because I'm a drummer and I'm used to doing that, right? But this was happening at telepathic speed. And it went back and forth and back and forth and back and forth. Every time I opened a mouth, I said, that is a Bigfoot, and he's telepathic. And every time I spoke, the laughter would stop on a dime, start on a dime, start on a dime. Like, totally, totally weird. So then it stopped. And my wife and I looked at each other for a while, and we finally summoned up the balls to go over to it. And we went over to the bush, and there was nothing there. And not only was there nothing there, it was a really dense bush that was a thicket that maybe a vole or a mouse could make it through the branches, but nothing bigger than that could make it through the branches. And no branches were broken. There was no trace of anything ever having been in the bush. And so that experience really freaked me out, because also that experience, it just sounded like a human laughing, a really deep-voiced human laughing, except it was a telepathic human laughing. And not only was it telepathic, it wasn't really there. Somehow it projected the voice or itself, or I don't know, you know, it was.
So how do you know it wasn't there? Couldn't it have just been behind the bush and you guys were on the other side?
No, the bush was standing alone on the bank of the river. So we could see all up and down the bank around it. It was like a solo bush alone. There was nothing near it. 30 feet on all sides was plain ground.
Gotcha, so
there was nothing in this bush, and we didn't see anything go in or come out. And I mean, we didn't, and we were right there. We were never further than 30 feet away from the bush. Hmm. We just got closer, in fact. So yeah, when we got up to it, and then the thing that happened was I read Tillamook Indian stories that described how Wild Woman had an ability at ventriloquism. And then I read a bunch of stories about how there were two young wild women that laughed all the time, and they were the Laughers, and they lived up the Nehalem River. And so even though this story was from basically like 1880, I felt like I had encountered one of the Laughers. And so that, too, was something that confirmed that I was dealing with a tribe of people and not with an animal. For me, you know, your mileage may vary. I mean, everybody goes out there, they think they're chasing a gorilla, fine. But, you know, I just, early on, I went a different direction.
Yeah, that's a great story.
Yeah.
And you know, that we're starting to like run out of time a little bit here, Henry, but we did want to hear about your book. So we heard about the title. And so why don't you tell everybody what it's about?
And share the title again for the audience.
Yes, please.
Because
Failing in a Cooler Way: How I Never Found Bigfoot. Okay. And what it's really about is, it's, you have to read it to really see what that title is about. But I have found that the biggest problem with our current research and Bigfoot is that science as we know it today cannot explain the puzzling powers of Bigfoot. You can tell from the stories I've just told that the puzzling powers of Bigfoot are the thing that I was interested in. And I'm not a person that's like, ooh, it's all paranormal. I'm a scientist, so I wanted to know how it worked. And I wanted to know how all that puzzling power stuff actually functioned in physics. I wanted to find a new physics that could explain what I've seen and what I've lived through, you know, just like every other person. So I modified Einstein's general relativity, particularly the Einstein field equations, to basically explain what existence is and what real actually means in terms of the recent Nobel Prize that's been awarded for proving that nothing's there until we look at it. Because now that's no longer a theory. We've actually recently awarded the Nobel Prize for proving that the local reality is false, which is kind of difficult to wrap your head around. But basically, I go and connect those things with Bigfoot, and I basically try to show you how Bigfoot is really adept at physics. And I try to describe this new physics theory based on relativity to explain the behavior of Bigfoot. Yes. And so nobody camps with me, right? Over in my corner. I don't see anybody else over there.
Ron Moorhead would camp with you.
Ron's been a friend for 40 years.
Ron's a cool guy.
I've been friends with Ron for 40 years. And yes, I can't say I agree with Ron, but I can say I can see where Ron's going and where he's coming from, you know. But I'm in that, you know, you could, yeah, maybe I could camp near him. You know, I might be just a little down
in the neighborhood, right?
Yeah, in the neighborhood, you know. But
so, with your work with the tribes, did that impact? I mean, does part of that come out in the book as well?
Without doubt, yeah, because I basically explain what I'm talking about. I'm not cryptic in the book. I just lay it all out. Yeah, the tribes know that. See, the strange connection is, yeah, it's tough to say this in sound bites, guys. the strange connection is that Einstein's modified theory, Bigfoot can do it the same thing with his mind. He doesn't need a machine. So the same modified Einstein theory explains what Bigfoot can do with their mind and what we can do with our technology and what we have done with our technology and what they have done with it. They're kind of super scientists, in my view, and engineers. And on a genetic level, because they can manipulate what I call the super force, they can, in fact, shapeshift and turn invisible and teleport, be telepathic. They can do all that stuff. But there's science behind it. There's actually physics. And so in my book, I dare to explain how the physics work and what the physics are and how we all have to catch up because we're way behind.
And so when is your book going to be released, Henry?
I don't know. It's out for editing right now. I sent it to 4 different editors and nobody has sent back a word yet. So I don't know what that means. It's been like a week and a half and I'm like, is it, you know, I don't know if it's super terrible or super good or I don't know what.
It sounds like a heavy read.
I tried my best to dumb it. I tried my best to dumb it down as far as I could to make it.
Good.
You know, I tried to stay out of the math really, really, but I couldn't avoid it. You know, right. Like I could not avoid math. And
so they're probably
Walk that line. But yeah, I was afraid of that the whole time because I was like, geez, as soon as you whip out Einstein's equation, everybody's going to shut the book, you know?
So for the audience, we'll bleep that part out.
So yeah, exactly. Quiet, right?
Yeah, so exactly. Henry, in the meantime, how can people follow you? Like, are you on Facebook or Twitter? Or
I'm on Facebook right now, but cool. I don't have my digital media together, man.
That's okay. Facebook's big enough.
Yeah. I'm on Facebook and I can be easily found on Facebook.
And we'll help once you get closer. And then of course, obviously,
I'm close now, but yeah, the editing, I've got a draft. I mean, I've thought of only a couple of tweaks, but yeah, I've got all the Indian tribes, maybe not all the people in the Indian tribes, but all the Indian tribes know that what you call Bigfoot is actually a Indian tribe that are in charge of this geometry of space-time. And so they speak to them as they are spirits. But see, the tribes speak to spirits a lot. They have a lot of ceremonies, a lot of secret private things they do. They have a lot of secret religions, and they speak to spirits all the time. And Bigfoot's one of those spirits they speak to. And Bigfoot, in some tribes' mind, is their greatest protector. They are in charge of this entire geometry of space-time that we all live in. And so they kind of look at them, some tribes look at them like they're gods, almost gods. They're closer to God than we are, but they're like husbands of Mother Earth. They're similar to angels. They're very powerful demigods. And a lot of tribes look at them that way, and they don't look at them at all like they're some kind of gorilla. And now when I say that, though, I'm speaking out of my hat, because if you were to interview any 10 tribal members, you're going to get 10 different opinions. Right. And they're not going to agree about a thing, and nobody's going to agree. And each tribe does have a completely different view of Bigfoot. Every treat the subject. There's a lot of famous ones like the Hamatsa of the Kwakiutl, where that's a secret wild man society that is within the Kwakiutl tribe. But now the Kwakiutl call themselves the Kwakawakawaka. They've changed their name. And Thomas Seward is actually on Facebook, mm-hmm. and is the hereditary chief of the Hamatsa. So he's the hereditary chief of the secret wild man society of that tribe. And yet, if you talk to Thomas Seward.
I've communicated with Thomas a few times too, so I can't wait.
If you talk to him, I can't get a beat on Thomas. I mean, he might just tell me nothing because I'm a white guy, but like, I'm not sure if he knows anything. You know, I'm like, what does he know?
Right.
Like, you know, because I'm like, wow. You know, he's not what I expected. But yes, I do think he just has a whole bunch of, if he's like most Indians I know, he's got a whole bunch of information he does not share.
I can understand that. Well, Henry, I knew this was going to happen. I feel like haven't touched base on about a dozen things that I want to talk to you about.
We're going to have you back on when the book comes out. That way we can see the cover for you.
Yeah,
and
I gotta do the cover. I haven't done the cover. You know, that's like.
Yeah. And it's been super enlightening to have you on. Absolutely.
And an honor. I mean, it's just like, you're royalty. You may not want to admit it, but you're legendary.
We thank you so much, Henry.
I did not know that. You know, it didn't come with any money. So I was like, oh, gee, I'm still same old broke dog.
Aw. It has been so cool having you on.
Yeah, you're broke, but you're rich in life.
Yeah.
Thank you very much, you guys.
All right, Henry. We'll have you back on when the book comes out.
You got it. Thank you very much, you guys.
Thanks, Henry.
Thank you.
Henry's so cool.
Oh, my gosh, yeah. He's
got so much stuff.
There's just so much.
I know.
I could have just.
We're going to have him back on when the book comes out.
There's
for
a lot
sure.
to talk about with Henry. And he's been out of it for a little while. Now he's back in. So it's excited.
He's got a lot of cool and very unique experiences.
And he plays a significant part of the history of the subject.
Absolutely.
I think that's really where I get a little giddy about all that history stuff in the subject. So
me too.
You guys are amazing. Don't forget to
like,
subscribe,
comment.
Yeah.
Also, you can follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, thebigfootinfluencers.com. So we thank you again, and yep, we look forward to.
And
I'm sorry.
Last thing.
Go, honey, go.
Go support Sasquatch Legend Meets Science too.
Yeah. Yep. And if you're going to be at the Ohio Bigfoot Conference, make sure you come over and say hi.
All right, guys.
All right, guys. Thank you so much.